Okay, this is Joan Weaver, and I'm at the Kinsley Library, and it is January 12th, 2015, and I'll be interviewing Charles Schmidt. Charles, what is your full name?
Charles Robert Schmidt.
And when were you born?
July 17th, 1926.
And where?
At Great Bend, Kansas, Barton County.
You said you were the only one of your siblings that was born in a hospital? Was that what you told me earlier?
Yes. Want to know why?
Yeah, tell us why.
Well,
or tell us, the rest were born at home, were they?
Yes, yes, by Dr. Stoltenberg. I was at Great Bend because it was very hot and it was harvest time. And mother had a little trouble with her firstborn. I was the secondborn. And so she had an aunt over toward Great Bend. So he took my mother to stay with her. And then when the time came, they took me to the Great Bend Hospital.
Okay. How did your people come to Edwards County? Or what's your ancestry there?
Okay. My grandpa Schmidt came with his brother to Edwards County through some relatives that were here that by the name of Stracers, and they were millers, and they had money from selling their mill, and so they come over here, and then they
came from where?
From Germany.
And how do you spell Stracer?
Strasser.
Okay.
And there were two brothers, and I guess their mother also came with them. And that was on my dad's, but my grandmother come from Alsace-Lorraine, France. And my grandpa met her through a rock quarry around in Hodgman County. They go to get rocks and haul them with their wagon or something and made buildings or things with them. And that's how they met.
Was he a stonemason?
No, they just a lot of stone posts and things like that. They squared them and made buildings because there wasn't that many trees around.
This is what we would call post rock?
I guess so, yeah. And because there were layers of them, and they'd break them and then haul them, and that's how they met each other. And so that's...
Okay, now what was his full name?
Grandpa John Schmidt, I don't know his...
Okay, and his wife's name was?
Josephine Berzinger.
Okay.
She was a Berzinger. And also, my Grandpa John's brother, Pete, married Grandma's sister.
Oh.
They both... No, married a Selmayr.
Selmayr?
South of town.
About what time period was this, do you know? That's a tough question.
I believe it was, I'm not sure, it was in the 1800s, I know, 1880s. Maybe.
1880s when they came?
I think so.
Okay. And then the other side of the family?
They were on the Werner's side, Robert Werner.
Is that W-E-R-N-E-R?
W-E-R-N-E-R. And they come with their mother, and there was five boys and one daughter. And the boys, my grandpa was, I think, 11 or 12, but they was from 7 to 14 years old, and they came on a ship. Grandpa was over...
Where did they come from?
Rhine.
Okay, Rhine area?
In the Rhine area.
You started to say they came on a ship?
Yes. Yes, I've got the letter on that, and I probably maybe ought to bring that sometime for...
Yeah, we can scan that.
Okay, and then you know for sure.
And they came to Edwards County too, or?
No, they came to.
Take your time. That's fine.
It's over east of here,
Hudson,
in that area, and there were three children born. My mother was the oldest of 14, and she was born there, and then I think Leonard and Hugo, and then about they bought a half section there and homesteaded it, and then they come because the church and school was quite a ways away. They bought a place which was about a mile and a quarter south of the St. Peter and Paul Church out north of Kinsley here, and that's where they had the rest of their children, and that's where I kind of grew up.
That was your home place?
No,
that was your grandparents.
My grandparents' home place,
okay.
Yes.
Your grandparents' home place.
Yeah, my home place was about a mile and three-quarter north of the church. Just about a mile and a quarter from where my grandpa Schmidt lived.
Mm-hmm.
Dad had some ground or farmed, or grandpa built his buildings there and things.
So what was your farm like that you grew up on?
It was a nice farm, and the ground there was good soil, and we had, my dad had, in his earlier years, he was kind of the thrasher with his brother, and he bought some land out in Marienthal County, and I remember he was telling about it, and so there was some relatives out there wanting some land, so he sold it to them, and he built a new house for his bride. When I was 2 years old, I got to move in it, and so we had a nice home, and we planted trees and evergreens north of the house, and they was just kind of up in the going. So when the dust storms come, well, we was really pretty well protected, and he had bought a new John Deere D tractor in 1925, so Grandpa thought he shouldn't, because if he'd get rid of the horses, they would ruin the world, and I always think about that as we progress. How much little did he know.
So your grandfather farmed with horses.
Yes.
And then your dad broke that pattern by buying the tractor.
Yeah.
Do you remember your grandfather farming with horses at all?
Well, he wasn't all that ambitious. My grandmother was, and of course they had a family, and I don't remember too much about the horses, but they had, you know, hogs and chickens and milk cows and like everybody else, and that's how they sustained. But he didn't farm very big, and it's mostly livestock.
And what was your farm, your dad? What?
Well, he was he liked machinery better than horses, so that's why I bought the tractor. And we had cattle. He wasn't real great on cattle, but he liked the farm and he liked machinery. And him and his brother had a thrashing machine and a steam engine. And Dad liked the steam engine, so he'd always have that ready to go. 4 in the morning, he'd fire it up so the steam, and when the help come, they'd set the machine. He'd tell about, sometimes it'd be early in the morning, you know, and then he'd watch the stars, and whichever way the stars would shoot, that'd be the way the wind was, so he could take the machine and have it all set and everything, and when the help come, and that's when then they could start thrashing, and that's where they made enough money where they could invest, and they continued to like to build together. They built a house there during the 30s for income, mm-hmm. you know.
I'm not a farmer, so he has a threshing machine, and he threshed for the neighbors and everybody?
Yes, between them.
So that's why he was making money with...
Yeah, back then, either it was cut with a header, you know, that, and that would just, that's before they made them into bundles, and they just put it on a stack, then pull the thrash machine beside the stack, and then pitch the stack of wheat or grain into the thrash machine, so you'd have a straw pile, and then that straw pile was beneficial for in the chicken houses and for bedding, and a lot of times when you couldn't grow nothing else, you put black strap molasses on it and have maybe a kind of a fence of some lumber or something that cattle could reach through, and you just rake straw up there and put that on, and it was something kind of a filler for them, I guess. Anything to get by. That was in the worst part of the 30s, when the grouse was on.
Okay, well, let's talk about the Dust Bowl a little bit.
Okay.
What do you remember?
Well, I must say, we really wasn't in the heart of it. We did get dust, especially when the wind come from the southwest, and because the dust that come from that area was more like talcum powder, and it'd come in the house just any which way. And I remember I was the second oldest of seven, so there was always an infant in the cradle or in the bed there. And mother, when the dust come, she had a sheet that she'd dampen her with sweat or wrung out and lay it over the bed so the dust wouldn't get on the infant. And that was quite regular. And
I guess maybe we should stop there. There were seven children. You want to give us their names in order?
Yes, my oldest brother, Harold, and then me, Charles, Alfred, Laverne, Paul, finally a daughter, Phyllis, 8 years later, another daughter, Jane.
Okay. That's quite a big family, so.
Yes, it was during the hard times, mm-hmm. but we really didn't, because we had plenty to eat.
Why did you have plenty to eat?
Because we had chickens, we had hogs, we had cattle, we had a big garden, lots of potatoes, and mother would take of course the cream and the eggs to town and trade them for flour, and the sacks of the flour was colored, and then she could make towels or garments out of that or anything they used it. So
now, how did you grow a garden during this drought time?
We had a windmill that pumped the water and have the hose to the garden, and then the potatoes was usually on our land. If you summer followed it and kept the weeds off, it retained the moisture. And then with that tractor, you had a four-bottom plow and had kind of a tube that fastened on the plow with a seat on the plow, and then we'd have our sliced potatoes, you know, with an eye showing on each part, mm-hmm. drop it down that tube right behind the mow board, and then the mow board behind that would cover the potatoes, maybe about 4 inches or just however deep you set your plow. And we'd have long rows, and then come back and then get in that so you'd have straight rows. And then with that, we had those what we call five-tooth cultivators. We'd take our horse that we had until we found something else to pull it with to go down, and then we'd hoe between. And then also there'd become like potato bugs when they mm-hmm. when they bloomed. Well, we had a little pan. I guess it was some of my mother's old bread pans, and we'd put some what they called tractor fuel. It was kind of an oily distance. And we'd put on gloves and then hold that up to where the bugs were and just stop them in the pan. And, of course, they wouldn't. That'd be the end of them. We'd go up and down the rows so they'd get a bloom. And then we'd get a single-row lister when the time come to dig them all. And we'd just set that down below the potatoes, and they'd just bring them up. And we'd go along, pick them from the side, and put them in a sack and put them in the cellar.
That sounds like a lot of jobs for you kids, was it?
Well, you had five boys, and believe me, we all learned how to work, mm-hmm. which was good.
Now, that picking potato bugs, and I've also picked, you pick up those potatoes by hand. It's,
oh, yes.
It's back-breaking.
Well, we were younger then. Mm-hmm. Back then, even the little ones, they'd, you know, do what they could. And of course, they'd have to be out amongst the other, you know, and we'd try and make fun of it, you know. Dad was always pretty good to us.
And did you have to water the potatoes, too?
No, we couldn't because it was just too far away. Mm-hmm. And that's why we summer followed that ground, you know. You wouldn't get much rain, but it'd hold the water. And by plowing 4 inches deep, you know, you'd be down to the moisture. And we would get some rains, mm-hmm. you know. And sometimes they'd just come as a gully washer, you know. They just drop real fast.
So that was enough to sustain potatoes, but not so much for wheat, which needed...
Well, I think the dust don't hurt our wheat. The electricity in the air, you know, kind of killed the wheat more than anything.
Do you remember harvesting wheat during the 30s at all, or little bits?
Very much so, because my dad had a header, you know. That was before they had the binders that made bundles out of them, and it just had a canvas. We cut the wheat off and then up into a header barge, which was just another four-wheel wagon besides that hold the wheat and the straw, and then they'd take that and make stacks out of it. If it was usually at that time, it was you'd go around and just go where there was good wheat, you know. Some places were better than others, and get what you could, and then make stacks, and then pull the thrash machine beside the stacks, or make two of them, you know, and then put them in between the stacks, and then you'd pitch them to the thrash machine, and then you'd make a straw pile. And so that's where you have that.
He was able to harvest some even in the 30s.
Yes. Yes, we was. I don't recall that. And then I know a lot of times my dad would just give some wheat to some people that didn't have any. And, you know, if they didn't have the equipment to farm or let the weeds grow, and some of them thought maybe if you let the weeds grow, they'd have something to hold the ground and the snow would blow. Well, that too would take all the moisture and the minerals out of it, and the wheat didn't have much to grow on.
So he was giving them seed wheat, you know, for another year, is what you mean?
Yes, mm-hmm. Just help them
get started another year?
Yeah, the whole community did, you know. It was always, you'd help each other.
Mm-hmm. What about, we've read stories about keeping the dust out of the house, but you said mostly that wasn't that big of a problem?
Well, it was to an extent. If you get that wind from the southwest and bring that real fine stuff in, yes, it was a problem, and we covered the tables and the things, and, you know, that needed to, and mealtime, but we also had some nice days, you know. Everybody, we talk about those terrible days, but then when the storm was over, the sun would shine, and the sky was blue and everything, but when they come rolling in, they were scary. My biggest scare was went out to get the cattle one time. They'd go in the ditches or wherever they could find, and then you'd go bring them in of an evening. And seeing that little brown thing on there, everybody but it come in so fast that of course, we knew that, and Dad always said, just follow a fence and kind of remember some of your posts and things so you know where you are.
So you were out getting the cattle, and a duster came in.
Yeah, it just looked just as small, so I hurried up and went out there to get them in. Well, we had a Shetland pony. I had the pony riding it and started the cattle, and by that time it just came and you couldn't see anything. But it only lasted for about 10 minutes, and I was following the fence. Of course, you get too close, and then there's electricity in that fence, you know, and it...
Were you riding the pony at that time, or had you gotten
out? Yeah, always bareback. And it was kind of, if you get to the fence, it'd probably throw you off and run home. But anyway, so I know I got, and the cattle were already home. They kind of knew the way. And my dad, I remember he was out in the yard waiting for me. He was concerned. But about 10 minutes, and then it cleared off. Just about the time I got home, we got a little rain and maybe a hailstone or two. And then with the wind... settled down quite a little bit. Initially, there was always that roll, and then sometimes it cleared up pretty quick, and then, always that Easter Sunday, you know.
Palm Sunday. You remember that storm?
Very much so.
Well, tell me about that.
It just turned dark, and I know the chickens went in.
Well, you were at home?
Yes.
Your family was all home?
Yes, yes. We suspicioned that there was someone give the weather out of Dodge City Radio if you could get it tuned in right, and he said it was a terrible low and the jet stream and all that he was explaining, and of course we was always, a farmer is always aware of the weather, or tries to be, so we was somewhat prepared, but that stage was completely dark and stayed for quite a while. That was one of the more severe ones. But actually, we didn't have Dutch that, you know, covered machinery or anything.
How many cattle was your dad running at that time?
Not all that many. We had probably 50 cows, which probably was enough when you had to feed them by a bundle every day, or straw or whatever it was.
And so when you'd bring them in, you just brought them close to the house in a corral or something to...
Yeah, they was used to just coming in the corral and you'd feed them. And if you had some draw with hay in it, you'd cut that in the summertime. And if you... I don't think we was in a terrible drought, because if you worked your ground right, it was... probably better ground to grow things than some of the lighter soils or sandier soils.
No, and you said the ditches and things held some water and...
Well, they held snow.
Snow.
Yeah. Thistles would blow in. There was a fence around everything, a barbed wire fence, and that'd catch the thistles. And the thistles would hold the snow. And the snow would make the weeds grow in the ditches, and that's where the cattle would go.
What did you do during that storm? Just stay in the house? Was
stayed close in the house. And at that time, my dad was kind of an ingenuity guy, and we had a 6-volt setup for the house. There was three batteries of 2-volt. There were glass batteries that looked like they held about 2 gallons of water each. That made 2 volts each. And then we had a generator up on a single pole set about 50 foot west of the house. And when that dust storm would come, it had a 2-blade propeller like an airplane, and had copper on the end of the propellers, you know, about 6 inches back. And went from our upstairs bedroom, there was a window that we could see that, and I remember at that time when the wind kept blowing, you could look out and around it make a kind of a bluish green circle from the electricity hitting on that. And then, of course, that battery had some balls that would tell you how much they were charged and all that. That charge would clear up, and you didn't want to overcharge it, so then you shut it off. And then we had switch lights in the house because it was new enough where it had some, but most of the time we used gas lights or mother light candles when it was storming. I don't know whether she should have, but she'd always light candles, and it was real bad while we'd kneel down and pray. Mm-hmm. And especially, you know, if Dad was outside or something, and you know, if the family was out, and we'd really, she worried a lot about us.
Well, yeah, you would. And we heard that it got very black that day.
It was very dark. Yeah. We lit candles, set them on the table, and prayed. And
now your electrical thing was made to run lights. You didn't have a refrigerator or anything at
it
that time.
It was only 6 volts and a 6 volt
lights
bulb.
And maybe
don't make much light, but it was handy because you could, for hallways and bathrooms and going up the stairs and downstairs, you didn't have to carry a candle or light. When it was really cold, winter time, we'd have these little bricks like they build houses, set on the stove, and then had a towel we'd wrap around it and tie it with string, and then we'd take it upstairs with us, and we could put it in our bed for our feet, and that would start us warm until we got the bed warm.
No central heating is what you're saying, do
you? Oh, no. No, none whatsoever. But the, of course, the cook stove had a place where you could put water, and it would heat itself, and then you'd have warm water.
Did you have water in the house, or did...
Yes, we did.
What year did you get that?
Pardon? Yeah, we had a big, I suppose it was 500, maybe 1,000-gallon steel tank in the basement, And then the windmill was set up. You'd have to put so much air in the tank, and then the windmill was set up where it would pump under pressure and pump water in there. You'd get enough pressure in it, then the faucet would run. Of course, if the wind didn't blow and the faucet went down, then you had the water bucket, but it was nice.
Yeah, I was going to say that. Your dad must have been pretty handy.
He was. He was very handy, and he loved to help outside, and I loved to help him. I think that's where I got my talent, I guess he'd call it, to take something old and fix it up and make it work.
Well, he seemed to like to be cutting edge, too. I mean, he wanted the tractor right away, and he's got water in the house and a little electricity.
Yeah, he was.
People around here didn't get it. Some of them didn't have electricity until the 50s.
And they'd call him to help them fix their house, and he'd do that, and they'd pay him a little bit, and that way he'd have money.
Mm-hmm. But you still had outside plumbing, though, probably, for...
No, we didn't.
You had...
And then had that little septic tank, and then we had a pump that they used on a steam engine sitting on there where you'd have to pump that thing out once in a while, and it went to the fruit trees over there, so nothing was wasted.
That was pretty handy. Do you remember rabbit drives? Were they up in that St. Mary Paul?
Yes, very much so.
Peter and Paul, rather?
Yeah, the one I remember the most was 2 miles north and 2 miles west of St. Peter and Paul Church. It was the Heinzelman's section, and we set up the day before snow fence in kind of a, if you can imagine, the figure six, set it up like that so we'd have a bow. Then the rabbits would come in the lead, and they'd circle around, and instead of running back out, they'd follow the others in, and that's kind of how you retained them. I remember this one nice Sunday, I think a lot of people did, and they advertised it in the paper, And depends how many people came out for the drive, and then they'd place them so far apart, whether they take one or usually 3, 4, 5, seldom a township, because it's too far to walk. Of course, that's 6x6. You walk 3 miles mm-hmm. to the center, and that's kind of where they put the pen. And so they'd set them out. Then we all had usually a stick or something, maybe a broken pitchfork stick about that size and maybe 2-3 foot long. And there were some people on horses that would kind of ride around. No guns were allowed, and you just kind of work them in. And we had quite a lot of rabbits in there. And then some time to, I guess, club the rabbits. But we were taught or told how to club a rabbit so it'd die instantly, mm-hmm. because no one wanted to hear a rabbit.
Yeah, I've heard them with
squeal and
I've heard them with the coyotes, and I wondered, but you didn't really have much of that going on.
What?
The coyotes
were in with them.
When a coyote kills a rabbit, it's an awful sound, you know.
It is.
And was that going on during a rabbit drive?
If somebody hit them on the back or injure them, yes, it mm-hmm. would. But nobody liked to hear that.
No.
Of course, a lot of them just wouldn't, but the thing was, there were so many of them that they just were detrimental to hay fields and things like that.
And you said there were coyotes that got caught in there, too. What did you do with those?
I think we got 6 of them. Now, then somebody probably shot them, because you didn't want to mess with them with a club.
No.
And I think they got $1 for a pair of ears in the county to get rid of the coyotes mm-hmm. at that time, when there was more rabbits than they could ever eat. But I don't know, it probably didn't last very long. But that's what I remember about that.
And what did they do with the rabbits?
They were all loaded up and sent to New York at that particular time. Fur coats were in great demand for the, I guess, more elite people mm-hmm. back in New York. So maybe our jackrabbits come back as a fur coat, who knows.
Did they have to clean them before?
No, we'd ship them right away, and I suppose they used that for food for mm-hmm. their dogs or, mm-hmm. you know, everything eats everything, and they didn't want to waste anything, mm-hmm. so that's what happened there.
Okay, and then grasshoppers, did you have a problem with them?
They come kind of after that. I think the year of 36 or 7 was, and that's when we had the turkey pool, and everybody raised lots of turkeys, and they even had, and because the turkeys would feast on the grasshoppers, so you didn't have to feed them much else, and it was a kind of a profitable thing that, and you kind of have to kind of watch the turkeys and herd them and watch for storms and things. But
what's a turkey pool?
I worked in a turkey pool.
Okay, so tell me what a turkey pool is.
They bring the turkeys in, and then I remember they'd hang them up and bleed them, I mm-hmm. guess I should say.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't recall, I think they took the heads off. And neck, and they shouldn't have, but they had a little tube to put in down to their craw and pumped a little extra food in there, mash,
mm-hmm.
so they'd weigh a little more.
So you had the turkeys, which controlled the grasshoppers, mm-hmm. but then you would harvest the turkeys.
Harvest the turkeys, and then they'd
would that be in the fall?
And then they'd pick them. Yes.
Yeah,
yes,
so because the winter you wouldn't have grasshoppers. So.
Well, that's right. Of course, you grew the turkeys when the grasshoppers were,
right.
But then in the fall, when the, yeah, then turkeys, we butchered them. And my job was to, they was all ready to go, and we'd stack them in these boxes, probably, let's see, three, six, maybe nine, six to nine in a box, and wire it shut, and then put it in a rail car.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd ship it wherever they would go.
And where were you doing this? Where was this?
The turkey pool. I think there might have come about two of them. If you go about a half a block east of the picture show, you know, the theater,
mm-hmm.
in that area, mm-hmm. on the south side.
And was it just set up in the fall, or was...
Oh,
was
well,
it, a, it
was
was
kind
a
of a vacant building, and it
oh,
was
okay.
kind of set up, and mm-hmm. where they have their racks. And I remember, let's see, Fred Fletcher, Chet Beidleman, no, not Chet, Glenn Beidleman, Chester, anyway, they were kind of the head of them. You know,
and all the farmers brought the turkeys in there.
Yes, yes, yes.
And they were
just, you know, so many a day, and then the whole, most of the help was from local farmers, you know, that had a job, and we get paid a little. And
they were, I assume, plucked and everything when you crated them, or
oh yeah, no. Yeah, they were killed and then. Scalded, I guess, mm-hmm. and the feathers and everything off of it. And they had a machine that had little rubber fingers on it, you know, with little knobs on it. You just hold that up and you just pull the feathers right off.
Oh.
Maybe the, you know, the wings or the big ones, mm-hmm. here, the tail, you had to pull out. But they looked pretty nice, mm-hmm. when we boxed them up.
Well, that's
loaded them in a freight car. And once in a while, when those steam engines come in, they'd bump the car and they'd knock them over. And so we had to go back out, or we was asked to go back out, but that was time and a half and a case of beer. Mr. Fletcher'd bring so. And us boys, we'd just throw them clear back up there. Made a lot of fun out of it.
Well, that's the first time we've had that story on tape, so that's a good
oh, really?
Story. Yeah.
Yeah, I was there.
Well, is there anything else you want to say about the Dust Bowl, and then we'll move on? Or is there any other?
Well, I guess that was probably it. We survived it, and a lot of neighbors that we just kind of worked together, and we all survived.
Would you like to say anything about that? That was basically a German Catholic neighborhood there.
Yes.
The
St. Peter and Paul was, and then there was a Lutheran church, and then there was a Methodist church. And everybody had they had baseball, you know, or a horseshoe, something that didn't cost anything, and it was a gathering. Of course, Dad had that thrash machine, and we'd go around, so we was acquainted to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had a ball field out in somebody's pasture there, different places. Then on Sundays, we'd have ball games.
Mm-hmm.
And I might as well tell this story.
Okay.
The Lutherans at that time, they were didn't have too many there, but they were short, so my dad, being a Catholic, well, he'd play on the Lutheran team. And he'd always kid him, says, Alphonse, you play so much better ball when you're a Lutheran than when you're a Catholic. And they'd had good fun about that. And we were all good neighbors to each other, you know, but each one had their methods, you know, and it's completely different now, you know, because they started marrying one or the other, and that all changed.
And where did you go to school?
At St. Peter and Paul School, under the guidance of the good sisters, mm-hmm. for 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a high regard for them. They might have had a ruler, but if there was two sisters for like 40 kids, 20 in the small two rooms, first grade to the fourth grade, and then the fourth grade to the eighth grade, And, of course, kids were ornery naturally, but they were quite a bit of discipline for the simple reason if you got in trouble at school, you got in trouble at home. Very well backed by the parents. And
so it was 8 grades, and how many kids did you have in your class, about?
Well, it all depended, and when I started, there was 3 of us only. Because, I don't know, somehow, and then there's some years there was more kids eligible, and all the way through. And
did you have separate classrooms for the grades?
No.
It was like a one room?
Just one room from 1 to 4, and then from 4 to 8. So it was kind of tough on the teachers to... And we had blackboards all around, and then you had to do your thing, and you know, but you just kind of intermingled there. And
so one sister had 4 grades, so
yes,
you had two sisters.
Each sister had 4 grades, mm-hmm. And then there was always a cook sister in the sister house that took care of that, and I remember we was playing, you know, I think what we called, you'd run and I fell, and back of my britches tore.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody made fun of me. She told me to go over to the sister's house, and she told me to go in the closet and take it off, and she patched it, put a patch on, and sent me back out. I was ever grateful to her.
Yeah.
They were very kind, but if you disobeyed, it was different.
Uh-huh. Any other stories about that one-room schoolhouse? Two-room schoolhouse.
They taught us about Jesus and moral standards and things like that. It was things that I still remember to this day.
And you had a wood stove in that, I take it, or coal?
No, there was a
coal stove
down in the basement. It's still out mm-hmm. there, and it's been redone, and we'd get some, as we got bigger, we'd go down and throw the coal in the stove from the coal room, you know, and take out the ashes, mm-hmm. and of course the restrooms were about pretty near a block east of the school. They had paths out there, one for the girls and one for the boys, you know, and that was, of course we didn't know any better, so...
So let's see, that gets us then. Where'd you go to high school?
At Kinsley.
Mm-hmm. And was there a bus or
no, we at the time we carpooled. Mm. I'd use my dad's car, and we'd have 5 different families. We'd each drive for a week, but we'd have, you know, the girls, so, and when school was out, well, you'd come right home and either walk home or they'd come and get us. We'd usually meet at what they called by the church, mm-hmm. Harry Lewis store, you know, by the schoolhouse there. And I was old enough, I guess, the younger girls, I got to drive the neighbor's cars, you know, or whoever's was to the school and back. Because I tried to be a pretty careful driver because they trusted me, and I liked that.
Mm-hmm. So you drove not only your dad's car, but you drove everybody else's car.
Well,
you were the designated driver?
Yeah, I was the designated driver, especially for the younger girls, mm-hmm. and things like that. Of course, let's see, I had Eugene Smith. He was my name. He drove his car the same. But there was the parents thought they were, you know, we're too young. I don't think maybe they didn't have a license. I'm not sure I had a license,
yeah.
But I probably did when I was 14.
No, you probably didn't, but
no,
that's okay.
No, probably didn't, but that's just, you went to school and then you come back. So that's how we did that. And then a little later on, let's see, in high school, on one of my years of sophomore, I guess I drove Dad's Model T. Picked up my cousin and drove that back and forth. Then one year I stayed in town with my uncle, and that's when one of my classmates and I, that was the war years, and Houston Sterrett run the theater, mm-hmm. and Barney Barncleft was the one that run the picture, the film, mm-hmm. you know, through. And then his wife, Claudine, when they both went to war, she took his place, and my schoolmate by the name of Jimmy Holman and I, they taught us how to run that, you know. And so the film was not in the best of shape back then. You'd have to run it through, you know, holding your finger, and if there was a break in it, you had to stop and resplice it. So you'd go right after school and get that all set up, and then you run it twice, you know, a night. And I don't know if that was every night or just on weekends. So it'd be about 11:30 time you got back home and to bed again, but that was interesting.
And you got paid for that.
Yes, we got paid for that. And I'll never forget that Christmas when his wife, Claudine, was the manager. She gave us each $100.
Oh, my word. What year would that have been about?
Probably 47.
That's a lot of money.
Yes, it was. When I first started school, I stayed with my uncle, and he got me a job taking the papers around on a bicycle. Every dog in town wanted to bite me. That didn't last very long.
You found a cure for that? I remember we had paper routes, too.
Yeah. And then one year, there was a gentleman out there by the name of Art Jensen that was a timekeeper for the WPA, and he was coming to town every day. So my cousin, Alan Gasser, the one that got killed in the war, and then my older brother and I rode in with him, and I don't know whether his dad gave him some gas money or something, they worked out, so we rode in with him, and then, you know, at the end where we'd ride back out, and either get in our Model T or our horse or whatever, and ride home or walk home. He lived just a quarter mile north of the church, so that was kind of the center.
Okay, I'm wondering now, because you said, when did you work at the theater? Was that when you were in high school?
When I was in high school.
Okay, and then you said 1947, but that's probably not right, because you...
I'm doubling up the years when we rode in, and when I... At that time, I...
Because you would have been out of high school by... What year did you graduate?
44,
so it had to be like 43 or 4 or something.
Yeah, probably 40.
Because you were in the Army in 44 to 46.
Yes. I made a mistake.
It clicked on, and I thought, so it would have been about, 43 or 4? Were you a junior or senior when you were doing that?
I think I was probably a junior.
Okay.
But I just said I drove the Model T. Yeah. So one of those years I did for a while when the weather was nice, and otherwise would get in some other way.
That was something else you brought up we didn't talk about. Do you remember your dad never had to work for the CCC or the WPA, or you didn't? Or
no, but a lot of the neighbors did or went to the CCC camps. He was, him and his brother built a house for a lady that had inherited something from some of her, and she wanted to build a house. It was probably northwest of St. Peter and Paul's Church, so it was pretty close for his brother and him, and they built that house. You know, he'd go to work with his Model T and his tools and saw and everything, and he liked carpentry, and so that's what...
That was some extra.
Yeah, or else he'd go fix things for somebody else. And then when this boy's got a little bigger, he'd get a job putting tin on a barn or something like that. Well, he'd take the boys along. We had a job.
Mm-hmm.
When he'd thrash someplace, he'd take us along because we knew how to throw the bundles just right in the thrash machine, heads first and all that.
Nobody ever got hurt with your threshing machine?
Not that I remember.
Weren't they sort of dangerous? Yeah. And little?
Well, yeah, it was. You had that long belt, you know, and if you had a little time, you'd hold your thumb there and watch the sparks go through the belt in there. Now they didn't. Once in a while, they'd have a pitchfork go in a thrash machine, and you'd have to stop and straighten the cylinder pegs out.
Well, then, had you known Clara growing up, or?
No, I didn't, and we only lived 6 miles apart.
Really?
So, and then she went to, when I was in high school, she was in, went to Wichita to the high school there.
There was a Catholic, was it?
Yes.
Several girls from town,
yeah,
I think, did
some
that.
Some become nuns, but she didn't. She come home, and then she had a nice job at the ASC office. It was in the courthouse then. And when I'd go up there, I noticed her. And I was too bashful to ask her for a date. Anyway, her dad told me later on I probably needed a little help. Anyway.
But you, when did you meet her? Before you went into service or after?
It was after.
After. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, then let's talk about your service a little bit. Did you enlist? Were you drafted?
No, we were drafted. I was 17 when I graduated from high school, and then in July I turned 18. And then you had to register, you know, and their quota was pretty hard to get. And so I registered, and then in August, while we went for our physical, along with John J. Riso and Joe Hines and some of my classmates, you know, and if you passed your physical, then you got about 30 days at home to get ready, and then and you went back, and then they assigned you to you got a preference, or they ask you where you'd like to go, and I wanted to go to the Air Force, you know, but they put me in the Navy. I remember Joe Hines, he thought he wanted to go to the Navy so bad, but he was in the Army, so anyway, you go where. So they sent me to Farragut, Idaho, for boot training.
And then what was your career like in the service?
Well, from there I went, I know I was a marksman when we had our rifle things, you know, in the Navy. It taught you about, you know, water and ship sinking and all that. So I got marksman, I guess I thought I was a pretty good one. So I was assigned to the anti-aircraft gunnery division. Then they sent me to Bainbridge, Maryland for two, three months, and you learned every part of that gun by heart, and there was a number of it, and our job that was in school there was to keep those guns in working order, you know, and you didn't use lights on the ship then because someone would give the thing away.
Mm-hmm.
So you just call down and get your part and put it. You learned how to assemble it blindfolded, and that was a 40 millimeter, you know, quad. It had four barrels on it, and it'd shoot sometimes tracers up, and you could set the timer on there with it. It'd explode, and the shrapnel would fly out sideways, and that might disable the airplane or kill the pilot or something. And you had the old inset rule. I noticed a lot, most of them had. Yours is not the reason why, yours is but to do or die. Seek and destroy, kill or you be killed. And that was over. Then we went to Crisis Neck, Rhode Island, and then we had people come and we'd try and teach them how to use those guns. So that was my job there. And we was there for, well, till the war ended, when they dropped the bomb in August of 45. Mm-hmm. 45. Yeah. Then we shot all the shells out in the ocean to get rid of them, I guess. What else would they do with them? And then I went to Boston, Massachusetts for a while, and then I was discharged in Oklahoma. All the town. Mm-hmm. And we got our discharge and $100 mustering out pay and a piece of paper to tell us don't spend it all in one place and a bus trip home. So that was.
And so you came home to be a farmer too, or what were your plans?
Yes. My interest was a farmer, but I had a sheep that they thought I'd be good at making shells and stuff, but you know, you always had a paper that told what you did and, mm-hmm. and what you might be successful at. If you wanted to get a job, you know, you'd take that. But I didn't really care. I had enough guns. So I wanted to be a farmer. So I come home. Most of the farm ground was taken up, you know, because I was kind of at the tail end of World War II. And I had enough money saved because I wasn't crazy about spending a lot or gambling or drinking or carousing. And I bought a Farm All M tractor, $1,200 I had. And I mortgaged that to buy a new baler, a John Deere baler that was a wire tie, you know, and there wasn't many things that make a bale then, and at that time there wasn't too much farm ground, so I'd bale. They weren't straw bales, you know, mm-hmm. instead of the straw piles, and they'd take the straw spreader off the combines, and I could work almost 16, 18 hours a day baling that straw for so much a bale, and that was a good money maker that paid my thing off. And eventually, I got enough money to get married, and then we started farming on the home place. And then,
you were working with your dad at that point, or
no? He what they I talked about the Strasher place. Mm-hmm. My dad eventually bought that, mm-hmm. and we fixed up the house a little bit, and that's where we lived for 23 years.
Okay.
But then. Clara's dad, Henry Herman, he had a friend that had acreage out of Wild Horse, Colorado. And so we decided we'd go out and farm that. But my brother-in-law, Lawrence Herman, he was, a few years younger than I. And we went out there. Well, we took our two Farm All M's, hooked them together, and he had a Krauss one way and I had a Krauss one way, so we hauled them out there and hooked them all together, so we cut quite a swath. There was 1800 acres there to farm, and of course 900 you had summer fallow, you worked that, and the rest was usually in wheat or something, and so we'd run that 12 hours each a day. We'd shoot an antelope or something, and we'd have meat to eat.
And was Clara with you then?
No.
No, she stayed.
She stayed home her sister to milk the cows and slop the hogs and feed the chickens. Bless her heart. It was the humble beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, you know, was asked us if it was making any money out there, and we'd have to tell them we didn't know. We hadn't raised anything yet. We did raise a barley crop one time, but then the hail got it, and so that was kind of a nag experience, and she went back to work at the ASC office, so kind of take us through that, and then we still had that baler, which we baled feed stacks or anything, you know, just so that was kept me going.
Mm-hmm. And so you were farming where during the 50s when that drought came? Were you?
During the 50s?
Because we had another little drought then.
Oh, yeah. Probably out. Yeah, from, 52 to 55, we farmed out at Wild Horse, Colorado. And that's where they said when they had the big flood you know, that it ran a quarter of an inch, all those little tails like that. But it was pretty dry out there. I mean, and dusty, and it the soil was pretty light, and that's stuff that probably shouldn't have been broke, but it was a good experience for both my brother-in-law and I. We always said it was we was more satisfied with anything here than what was out there.
Yeah. It made you thankful for back here.
You bet.
Yeah, that probably wasn't the best years to go out there either, because because we had a little bit of a drought here for those years.
Yeah, well, the soil was light, and then it'd blow, it cycled same like here. Mm-hmm. Those that stayed there did quite well, but it took a lot of acres, and you were so far from everything, you know, and it was, anyway, so we was able to make payment on a pasture that we bought from Louis Lockwood with our cream checks that we had saved up, and then we'd always buy those, a lot of around there had dairy cows, you know, Holsteins, and we'd buy the bull calves and raise them, and then I had this quarter of grass that we bought that I could pasture them, and so that was a little extra income. And I had the baler where I'd bale feed for half, you know, they didn't want to pay, so I had plenty of feed, and if you had plenty of feed, the bank was interested, or would loan you money for small calves, or we did have a cow herd for a while, and then we went into the more feeder cattle, and especially if it was wheat pasture. And then it kind of grew like Topsy for a while. Clara was a real good partner of mine as far as when we fed cattle and keeping books and everything. I was the worker, and she was, I couldn't have succeeded like we did without her help. She was a good partner.
It was a partnership.
And still is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So when did you move to town or whatever?
In 1973.
And what precipitated that?
Well, we was on my dad's farm, and we kind of wanted a home of our own. And he says, well, if I sell it to you, then I make trouble, he says. You can probably get it sometime. But what he did, he parceled it out to everybody. And then when he died, he says, then they can blame me.
Mm-hmm.
He says, so I don't want, because he had trouble when he was on his parents' place. And Grandma says, my kids will never fight. But it was, so he learned a lesson from there. So that worked out quite well.
Because then you were very active as a city person.
I had my fingers in all the pie, I guess. Or, I don't know. My dad always thought I was too big for my britches, and I'd lose it all. And my father-in-law says you have to have your name on that land, and so you got something to get up in the morning for, and go out, and so you have. Make your payments, mm-hmm. else they take it away from you. Well, that was kind of true. I mean, so we didn't spend much money foolishly, and the cattle business worked out real good. And if you was, anyway, the bankers were pretty good. Of course, interest was 17%. And sometimes we'd, you know, but. And we bought an acreage out in the sand hills, about 1,800 acres, and put down an irrigation well, which I had some legal troubles because I didn't know about the area, so that's why I got in the lawsuit. But that worked out all right. It was not a fun time at all, but then we ended up selling that out there and invested more in But we did raise a good corn crop for the first one to put down the first irrigation well out in that area.
You were the first one in that area?
In that area. There was my neighbor by the name of Barney Barncliffe, and he was a friend of mine, and he had irrigation right beside me, and wonderful alfalfa up and down them hills, and he said, "That'll work, Charlie. I'll help you with that," which he did. Most of the neighbors were pretty good, but I had to go through a lady's pasture to get there, and she didn't like that, and I got in a lawsuit, but that was just kind of more of a handicap.
Nuisance.
Well, your money borrowing for cattle, and that is limited, and we were highly leveraged anyway, but it all worked out.
Well, I was just reminded last Saturday, because of our open house, some people came who were interested in the tractor cave. Did you have any involvement with the American Ag Movement, or?
Well.
If not, why?
Because they were determined, but I thought there was better ways to do that than that. That was a lot of effort, and I remember I was on a board too at that time. And when they went, here they come with the tractor sitting on the scales where nobody could come, you know. I said, "Well, that's defeating us," I says. And they thought that would teach us. So anyway, I talked to him, and he was pretty radical about it. And I told him, "Well, I'll give you a check for $100 that you can use for fuel to go there, help the cause there." Well, he agreed to that, so he got off the scale and went on. He had money for gas, so he drove to Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
So that was about my...
That was your contribution.
Yeah, well...
Coerced.
Yeah, that's right. And their intentions was honorable, and those that, you know, could afford to, and they made their point, I guess.
Well, yeah, most of them said they made their point, but didn't do any good.
Well,
because of the banks and the interest being so high and the...
Well, yeah, and I couldn't go because I couldn't afford to, you know. But
well, you had cattle too, right?
Oh yes.
It was hard. You can't leave cattle like a wheat farmer can leave in the wintertime.
I had cattle and. Of course, we had hired help too at that time, and we had a lot of things going. My dad worried about me.
I think you turned out okay.
Well, yeah, things, you know, got better, and Clara's brothers they were cattlemen and everything, you know, and they took me along to the fall calf sale up in the Dakotas, which I was happy to do because I didn't know much more than about our local sale barn. And when we was up there for 3 days, of course then Clara was home with her sister doing the chores there. But the 3 days, first we come about 6 o'clock in the evening, we drove all night up to Chadron, Nebraska, or Belfouge, up in at a cattle sale. Arrived there about that time, and they bought, I don't know, 2-3 loads of cattle. Then you put them on rail cars back then to send them home.
What year are we talking here about?
52.
Okay.
In that area. And people at home, they liked the calves, so they called George and Joe and see if they'd fill some orders for them. So our 3 days turned into about 10. But they, under their guidance, I also sent home a couple loads, you know. And they did quite well for me that winter. So that's where I kind of got started. We sold the cows and kind of got started with just the feeder calves. Mm-hmm. You know, you could feed them. They'd only weigh about 350 or 400 pounds. And on wheat, and if you had shelter for them in the storm, why, they did quite well. And then when they get up to about 700 pounds, why, they could make you pretty good money. Then we'd put them in the feedlot.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we've lost a lot of money in the feedlot, too. But the thing is, you usually inventory them in at feeder cattle price, and then if you've had a real good year, well, you buy feed so you don't have to pay income tax, and then so, but the price when you put them in and the price when you sold them, plus the price for the feed, you'd maybe, perhaps we've lost up to $200 a head, which they have more than that here just in the last few years until the droughts, and now they're making that back. So it cycles like that. If you can hang in when the tough times, well, the good times have come.
Now, where was the feedlot that you had?
They were various around here, and they had just built this one south of Kinsley.
Okay, out where I live.
Yeah, out where you live. And we all bought stock in that, you know, and that was paid back.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd feed them over to Pawnee Valley because we had a alfalfa ground there we was renting, and if we fed cattle there, they'd give us a good price for our alfalfa.
Mm-hmm.
So that made that work, and then we fed over to Pawnee Rock and just
wherever.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then you were on the city commission for a lot of years, and we've done some interviewing.
Four years.
What? And you were on the co-op board. What other things did your father think you had your too many fingers in pies?
Well, I started out as a township, on the township board.
Okay.
Yeah. The Grand Knight of the Knights of Columbus. Her and I got her airplane pilot's license.
Oh, you did? Yeah, when did you do that?
72 and 73, back there.
And you had a plane?
Yes.
What?
Cessna 172, 162. And one year, the cattle were good and the crops were good, so we traded it for a brand new airplane, 172, with a variable speed prop. You could land on roads and took a shorter runway, you know, and we had cattle out at Calvesta, and you'd log that down and see if you could take that off of your income tax.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we worked that, so it's kind of robbed Uncle Sam of his tax to pay for our airplane. And let's see, I think I put 1,400 hours on it. Then we got kind of busy and everything. I wasn't using it much. Things were changing, and I could sell it for a couple thousand more than I give for it. So I sold it.
So you mainly used the plane for the cattle, or did you take trips too? And
oh, we used it for both.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I used it quite a bit to go out, fly out. Well, you know, we got to buying cattle on mm-hmm. fall. Fly out to Chadron, Colorado, or Chadron, Nebraska, or places like that, or let's see, in Arkansas, can't remember the town. Yeah, flew down there and bought a lot of cattle.
Now, were there a lot of women who got their pilot's license back then?
Oh.
Was she unusual, or was she usual?
Oh, no, she just a good little partner of mine.
Yeah.
And then we had just got our children, you know, or mm-hmm. we adopted our two children, and we would join Flying Farmers, which was a real good thing, you know, because they didn't believe in drinking or partying or anything, but it was just, that didn't work. And then you had your meetings, and then with other people, and sometimes we'd have the annual meetings or something, or, you know, the national meetings. One time up in Canada, and the kids went up there, and they got the people, all of us had sponsors, you know, and they took them where they was all night, and the sun just went down a little bit, and then it went back up. They got to experience that. And they still have friends in Canada that they met then. And we'd have in different places, sometimes down in Texas and in Norfolk, Virginia, and that's where we'd have our once a year.
So,
meeting of the whole United States. Of course, Kansas had their own, and Clara was Kansas Queen there for a while, and I was president of the club for, in 82. I had my finger in hip tie too.
Mm-hmm.
But that was one of my most enjoyable things.
In so it was sort of like what today that we would have a, motor home clubs. I mean,
Yes, only
it was with airplanes.
Yeah, this was with airplanes. And
so you flew into your meetings.
We also was in on, you know, those charity flights which they mm-hmm. had for the handicapped kids in Topeka, you know. Mm-hmm. I guess he called them the crippled kids, but they call them handicapped now. And there were some from here. And then we did have those flights in the fall, you know, charity flights. Mm-hmm. We'd give people's ride, and they'd mm-hmm. give us money. And let's see, the year I was president, it went up to 90-some thousand we had given them. And we had a good year that time. We had different districts, six districts in Kansas. And then you had your district people, the three of them, that they'd set this up in their district and have these charity flights on a certain day in October, you know, they could pick their own. And we got enough that time that it ended up 106,000 then total mm-hmm. from when they started. But it's not too many of them have airplanes anymore, but they still have when we have our Christmas get together, why, we just give money, and it's, I don't know.
What's that money used for?
The children.
The handicapped.
Yeah, the handicapped children. It's mm-hmm. kind of got the thing, it started, you know, from that, and then it just kind of keeps on going. Mm-hmm. Although they've got more. Now it's more, you know, with, I guess, the government mm-hmm. supports, mm-hmm. you know, they've
right.
got support. But it was a good thing and a nice thing that we've done.
Mm-hmm. I wasn't clear. Were there other women that had their pilot's licenses, or was it mainly the men, or was it both?
Oh, no, there was a lot of women.
A lot of women that did.
The fact is, when I was taking my training, there was a lady, a young lady, that she took her pilot's training. And I remember just before you take your final, you know, they get pretty rough with you. And she come in there, she was just ahead before I was taking my finals. She was crying. She says, he's picking on me. But, you know, they don't let you make mistakes. They mm-hmm. let excuse mistakes. But
right.
when they get there, where you do everything just right. Mm-hmm. Well, she ended up being given lessons, mm-hmm. pilot lessons.
Cool.
Then. So, yeah, there. And then we had another couple in our club. He went to try take a pilot's, you know, just they had these, you could for $10 you could take a flight, and then mm-hmm. just to kind of try out. And he took his wife with him. She wasn't crazy about it. But anyway, it ended up, she's the one that got the pilot's license, and she taught instruments and everything else.
Hmm.
So there was.
There were quite a few women then.
And a lot of times they're good.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Clara was good with the maps mm-hmm. and everything. And I like to fly the airplane to make it work, you know, the mechanical stuff, you know, and crosswinds and all that stuff. And she'd read the maps, and so we got along real good.
Now, you said you adopted two children. You want to say anything about them on this tape?
Yes. We was 10 years wanting children so bad, and sometimes we'd go family reunion. Charles, you don't have children, do you? It just tear mm-hmm. us up.
Mm-hmm.
So finally, we were blessed with a boy and a girl, two of the nicest children we could ever hope for. Of course, 20 years ago, the 11th, we lost our boy in the result of a wreck.
Mm-hmm.
So, but we still have our daughter.
Mm-hmm.
So it was. That was a hard time in my life,
mm-hmm.
even though I was grateful I had him for 35 years,
mm-hmm.
and two grandchildren, mm-hmm. or three granddaughters, you know, 4, 6, and 9, It was tough for them to lose their dad. Mm-hmm. He was so proud of them, but we still have them. And he was talking to his mother. He was healthy and everything, and you know, so they wouldn't know about donating his organs. And he told Clara, he said, well, why shouldn't I? I won't need them anymore. So I guess his heart is still around in place, and his eyes.
That's wonderful.
He had wonderful eyesight. It's just like a see at night and everything. And healthy as he could be, but he did smoke, so they did. But his kidneys and all those things. So I guess there's a lot of mm-hmm. other people
mm-hmm.
thanking him
so
for that.
So wonderful. Wonderful.
Anyway, so we've had our joys, we've had our sorrows.
So what do you think about growing up in Edwards County and living here all your life? Has this been a good place? Is it?
Well, I got to see quite a little bit, you know, while we was in the service. And I had never seen any place I liked better. And I think it's just a wonderful place to live and raise a family. In my experience, my life through here, I'm well satisfied.
Any philosophy of life you'd like to end with? You've given us quite a few little tidbits as we went through this interview.
Well, they always ask me, we've just 65 and a half years of marriage. How come? I said, well, trust and forgiveness. Mm-hmm. If you don't trust each other, you're in trouble. And then nobody's perfect to forgive.
That's good advice.
Mm-hmm. And if you don't have the Lord in your life, it's pretty tough. And we both have that.
Strong faith.